I have right here on the phone Steve Martin. I've never got a chance to say hello, Steve Martin. How are you?
Hey, how are you?
Doing good.
Great
doing
to be
good.
On a show. I'll never forget the host's name during the show. It's fantastic.
You don't have to write it down on your hand.
Yeah.
When the opening of the show, I played Tony Trischka's double banjo bluegrass spectacular album, which won so many awards. I think Tony had to buy an addition onto the home. And
right.
I played The Crow from that, which is a tune that you wrote. And we were talking right before we came on air about how that tune kind of played back into your reemergence back into banjo playing.
Yes. Tony asked me to appear on that record. And actually, a couple of years before that, I don't remember what year that was, but Earl Scruggs asked me to play on his, I think it was 75th anniversary record or 70th or something. And I was a little rusty, I realized. When he played the recording of Foggy Mountain Breakdown I was supposed to play on, it was really fast. And I kept up, but I didn't play everything I wanted to play on it because it was so fast. And I started practicing again, you know, much more than I had been. And I started to write songs again. And when Tony asked me to play, I thought, I told him, I said, look, it doesn't do me any good to go play a bluegrass standard, because there's so many people who can do that way better than I could, but I have some songs I've written. And so he came over and we picked The Crow, and it got some airplay, and it kind of encouraged me to do a record. And I at first I thought I'd do a little compilation record. Maybe I'd play four of my songs and pay tribute to some other musicians that I really liked, but when I started adding up the number of tunes I had, I realized I had enough for a record, and that turned into my first CD produced by John McEwen called The Crow.
That was The Crow album, and that, I guess, yeah. then Steve, when I played Daddy Played the Banjo, that came from that also, did it not?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Sung by the great Tim O'Brien.
Oh, wow. Boy, you know, I will say this for you. I don't know about your choices of calling in here today, but you have excellent judgment in picking out people to join you.
I also had the great luck of getting Vince Gill and Dolly Parton to sing on a tune, too. And I was just sort of awestruck by both of them, first of all, because I've known them my whole life. But when Vince Gill came in and sat down and played banjo better than I could, I thought, oh, well, okay. this guy's really good.
I guess you didn't try to sing better than Vince. You just figured you'd leave that go.
Well, I don't think there's many people who can do that.
No, I don't think so. And then the new album, and we're going to talk about the new album. I have as much time as you have. We talked about this a little bit, but the new album, Love Has Come For You, I'll just tell you, and I'm not saying this because you're on the show. I've said this before. I got it. I have it in my home. I take it out. I put it in my car. I take it in my office, and I take it back in my car. And I come back. I absolutely love the music on this album.
Well, thank you so much. Edie and I, secretly, I wouldn't say that if I were on the radio. I'd just send this to you.
Okay, well, there's nobody listening.
I
go ahead. It's just
but
you and me, Steve.
We're actually quite proud of it, and we really feel like we made the music we wanted to make, along with the producer of the record, Peter Asher. And we'll talk about him in a minute, because you told me you didn't really know who he was.
Yeah,
I'd be happy to tell you who he was.
I would like to know
who he is. But I feel like the music we made was exactly what we wanted to do, and that's very hard to do, because often you think, well, it's sort of the music I wanted to do, or it sounds kind of like the music I wanted to do, but sometimes you don't quite know what it is you want to do, and you sort of get lucky with what came out. But in this case, it was a sound I'd kind of been living in my head with for a long, long time, and I happened to team up with a great, great lyricist and voice.
Oh my! Oh my! I mean, I'm ignorant about these things, but I remember the New Bohemians, and I and as I say, I just didn't follow her career because I'm just stupid. But as I listen to her sing on this, I've gone back and her singing and the lyrics and what she puts in the words are, I mean, it's just kind of like makes you want to pull the car over.
Well, I'll tell her. You said that.
Well, I mean, yeah, you don't have to, but I'm sure she's listening somewhere. Yeah. But I mean, to me, it's just, I felt like, oh, I missed out on the last 20 years of hearing Edie Brickell sing and write words.
Well, she laid low for the last 20 years. She was raising children, and that became her priority. And she kept the music going, I feel, and without really properly exposing it. But this record, she kind of fell into the zone of her creativity, I feel. And it just, you know, we co-wrote these songs together and did it in a very odd way, which worked well for us.
Well, and I've heard you talk about that before, but explain a little bit in case the people listening. And by the way, if you're tuning in now, we're talking to Steve Martin. Thanks so much for calling in. Explain a little bit about the process that you and Edie went through on this. I've heard you talk about it. It's pretty neat.
Yes. Well, we met at a party, and we decided to, she suggested that we write songs together. I hadn't really ever done that. I'd always written songs alone. Sometimes with the Steep Canyon Rangers, I had done a few things, and we worked together on a couple of tunes. But that's really a gangbang, you know. There's like five of them and one of me, and I always had something to start with. But this was unusual. I'd never really done it before, so we didn't really have a working method. And we met, and I played a tune for her. She asked me if I had any stray tunes, and I did. Didn't have lyrics, and so I played her a song. And we kind of sat around a little shy with each other, and she took it away on a tape recording. And then she emailed me back the song with lyrics, and I really liked what she did. And that song became on the record, "Sun's Gonna Shine."
Oh,
and I thought, gee, that worked out well. And we started. I started writing banjo melodies and sending them to her. And she would spend time with them. And by the way, it was astonishingly a short amount of time. Sometimes it would be overnight.
Wow.
And she would email me back a completed song. It was all done, you know, just banjo and voice. And we just kept working that way. And we actually didn't even meet. And so I was able to go away and work on the tunes on my and then she would be able to spend alone time. I really liked having alone time to work on songs on my end. And she said she would just put the music on in her kitchen and sing along with it and compose these really surprising lyrics with it.
Well, the combination, it has a feel, and if people, if you haven't listened to the album yet, it has a very comfortable, casual feel. When you listen to it, and of course you were playing on it, but when you listen to it, don't you have that feeling that it's just sort of like it all melds together very easily?
I was especially pleased, I'll say yes, but I was especially pleased that the album has a unity.
Yes.
In all 13 of the songs that we didn't expect. We didn't know what we were doing. You know, we didn't even set out to make an album. We didn't even know if we were going to write one song, two songs. Or, you know, 13 is what we ended up with. And so I was, like I say, we didn't even start out to make a record. And here we ended up with one.
A very nice one. I love, you know, you're playing. Can you mentioned the fact that when, and I remember the thing you're talking about when Earl kind of, everybody was playing a break on Foggy Mountain Breakdown. And I think Earl, he may have won a Grammy for that, I think.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, and you were on that. So, but when I go back and I listen to, let's say like, gosh, I found that I was thumbing around this week when we realized you were going to make it on the Saturday, and just playing music out of the Steve Martin Brothers, okay, which makes me giggle a little bit for obvious reasons. But I listened to your playing there, and I think this, Steve, because I play a banjo, I think I could do that. And I even thought that then, because I remember when the album came out, but what you're doing now, I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're,
well, thank you.
You're playing him someplace else now.
Well, I think what I've done in the last 3 or 4 years is synthesize the different styles that I've learned, which was, you know, started with Pete Seeger style, then I learned Scrugg style the best I could. And then I learned other styles, too, in the 60s that were around, because the, you know, Scrugg style had not solidified as the style. There were a lot of folk styles,
yeah,
too. Some of it done by Billy Fair and different players. And there was Clawhammer, definitely. And when I heard Clawhammer, I thought, oh my God, I've been practicing three finger and now I have to learn a whole other style because I love it. And you know, it's like the difference between tap dance and ballet. People who...
Oh, good. Good analogy.
People who do ballet have a hard time doing tap dance because it's toes in and toes out. It's a big difference. And I'm so glad I persisted with Clawhammer, which then was called trailing.
Right.
Because it has so affected the way I play today. And I'm so glad I can shift back and forth between three finger and Clawhammer. It's so affected my music.
Oh, I mean, it doesn't. Do you think that it helps you as you're writing a melody and you're thinking back in this project with Edie? Do you write? How do the melodies differ when you're writing on, when you're doing the frailing or the clawhammer versus the three finger style? You're right. It probably affects how you think to write a melody, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I find with clawhammer, I'll use a lot more. What do you call it? Unison notes. I'll play double strings that are hitting the same note and let it resonate more. And you can also, if you hit a double string, you might have the other strings will resonate a lot, creating a very moody sound, especially when you're in the tuning of double C. Hmm. You get these very moody overtones that I love. You can hear that on the song Remember on the record and different tunes. And in three finger, you just get a completely different sound, which I like. I'm just writing more songs in, you know, three finger and in open G tuning lately, and that just creates a drive, you know, it just twists your brain around a little bit in good, surprising ways when you alternate styles.
The banjo that you play on this album, and I've seen the videos, I look at the pictures, it looks to be a deeper pot than what I would normally think to be an open back, on the open back tunes that you're playing. Is that a fair statement?
It might be. On the clawhammer, I play that Deering Mark Johnson model.
Okay, that's what that is.
Yeah, and on the three finger, I play my Gibson Top Tension.
Okay.
This 1936.
Okay.
The date is a little vague because they put them together at different times, but the parts are from 1936.
Okay.
Anyway,
the open back that you play, just from my visual it looked, and when I say deeper than normal, you know, hanging over here on a peg is I do keep an open back handy, although it's not what I play mostly. The pot of what you're playing looks to be much deeper, and I just was wondering. I guess the reason I asked the question is, I think it affects the tone that you're getting just because of that deeper sound. Well,
it might, but also Mark Johnson gave me an open back banjo tone guard.
Oh.
Which goes over the back of the banjo. It's sort of a wire frame that keeps the banjo from pressing against your chest or stomach. So it doesn't, so it keeps it open. It doesn't collapse the tone like it has, as though it has a resonator on it.
Oh, okay. All right. So it keeps that whole area open.
Yeah, that might contribute to it, too. It's a great little item.
I've never heard of that before. See what you learn.
Some clawhammer players like to kind of shut the banjo tone down. They put a towel in it.
Yeah, sponges.
They put nylon strings on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly the opposite of what I like to do. I like to put steel strings on it and keep the sound very open and sharp.
Yes, it's very clean. Your style is very clean and very clear, and the notes are all very crisp. And even though you're playing in that style, which you're right, a lot of people just jam a bunch of stuff in there, but they want that sound. But what you're talking about is
a different sound.
Your ear is tuned for, and I've never heard of that tone guard. That's pretty neat. It works well. Do you want to play a tune you mentioned, Remember Me This Way? You want to throw that one out and then let people listen
sure,
so we know what we're talking about? All right, man, hold on a second. All right, Steve, we just listened to Remember Me This Way. You mentioned it, so I thought it would be a good opportunity to play a cut from the album. I will tell you that in the chat room, people are falling in love with this sound. Now, a lot of them may not have heard it before, but the reaction was very good. Now, keep in mind, not everybody that listens tunes into the chat room, but it's a good representative, I think, of the people reacting are all thumbs up and hearts and all those little emoticons. So that struck a bell.
Oh, that's nice. You know, I always felt that that the banjo could be a much broader instrument and be very appealing when used in a certain way with orchestral instruments, especially strings, because the long line of strings and the emotive quality of strings would work well with this sort of staccato and emotional line of the banjo. Mm. And I was able to actually, you know, experiment with it in this album. I mean, there's some songs that are what I would call sort of definitely a bluegrass type song, and then there's other songs like Remember that sort of play with that idea.
Well, in the last couple of weeks since I've been playing with this, I've played maybe Get Along, Stray Dog. I thought that was something we could fit in easy enough. That's maybe what you're thinking about on the other side of that sound. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I did want to ask you, by the way, about the producer, because I love liner notes, and thank you so much for ever put this together to put little nuggets in throughout the whole thing, because it used to be when you could only afford one vinyl album a month, you read every bit of it because that's all you had to look at. And I'm reading through here, I see Peter Asher's name, not just as a producer, but like guitar, percussion, vocals. And I asked you when we just chatted briefly before the show started, should I know Peter Asher? Because it seems like he's got a nice... he's done a really nice job of putting this together, not without contribution from you and Edie, certainly, but should I know Peter Asher? Tell me.
Well, Peter Asher, yes, you should, because, I mean, you should just for your own good, but Peter Asher started as an act in the 60s as Peter and Gordon.
Oh!
And they had a huge hit.
Of course.
Called, I'm blanking on it, Love... Don't Lock Me Away, which was written by Lennon and McCartney.
Yes.
And
thanks for singing, by the way.
His sister, his sister is Jane Asher, who was Paul McCartney's girlfriend for a long, long while. And then he went on, so they had all these hits with Peter and Gordon, and then he became a record producer. And produced all of the early James Taylor records, and all of Linda Ronstadt's records, and went on to have a fantastic career in music, and still has a fantastic career in music. And he became a friend of ours through the comedian Eric Idle,
sure,
of Monty Python.
Wow, sure.
And one night we were sitting around. I was just for fun. I was playing him our demo records. Our EDs and my demo record, wasn't even a record, our demo iPhone. and then the next day I thought, what about, we were looking for a producer. We were very afraid of producers because, you know, we thought, well, what if the mood changes? Because right then it was just banjo and voice, and we really liked the way that sounded. And talked to Peter, and he understood it, and we were lucky to get him. That's the story of Peter Asher.
Yeah, thanks enough for you to put Peter and Gordon. Now, I have to tell you this. In the chat room is Mark Horowitz. And Mark, as I told Mark, he's my lifeline if I get stuck. But Mark has already answered the question. It's World Without Love.
World Without Love, right?
Yeah, yeah. So there's a nice shout out to Mark Horowitz for coming to rescue me again.
Right.
Oh, okay, Peter Asher, excellent.
Banjo player himself, Mark Collins.
Oh, Mark, yeah, he is, absolutely is. He's been on the show. Mark has become kind of my roving, immobile reporter. I always tell Mark, whenever you want to call in, if I can fit you in. I think he's been on about three times. He helped me with Noam Pikilny. So, you know, just in case I needed, I had Noam on for a while, and then the deal was to patch Mark in because they were doing this New York Banjo Summit, and that would kind of, you know, help bring some more relevance to, I know Noam's work, but I don't know a lot about him, and it was just made it very easy for me. And Mark,
he's a great guy, and by the way, a great banjo player and a great wit.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes, very much so. I was going to ask you, you were talking about the way this album's come together. If I have a second, first of all, good choice again on Steep Canyon Rangers, all right? Something I've always wanted to tell you that I knew when you were coming back in and you teamed up with Steep Canyon Rangers, they are as fine and original, well thought of as a band unit, I think, in all of bluegrass right now. So you did well. You're making good choices,
well,
Steve.
I couldn't agree more, but I have to say that my choice was pure luck. And because when I first did my first album, The Crow, my agent said, well, you know, you have an album, you have to go on tour. And I said, what? I said, I haven't been on tour in 35 years. He said, no, you got to go on tour. And I said, I haven't even played in a band ever. And he said, I still, you got to go on tour. And he said, you have two choices. You can either find band members, and that means that every time you go out, you have to find out if they're individually available, or you can find an existing band. That means they're either all available or all aren't. And I said, well, I do know one band, the Steep Canyon Rangers, whom I met in North Carolina one night at a party.
Yeah.
And they were friends of my wife. And so I contacted them, and it just turned out to be the luckiest day of my life, of my professional banjo playing life, anyway. And they're great guys. They're very creative. They have the same work ethic I do. They love to put on a good show. And by the way, they're also really good songwriters. That's they have a new record coming in the summer. That's fantastic.
The thing about them too, and if you're tuned in, we're talking to Steve Martin, and I need to remember to do that every once in a while. The sound that they have is bluegrass, but it's a different sort of bluegrass sound because it's the songs that they write. It's maybe the voicings that they use, and they're all so talented. But when you listen to them, you know not just that it's them singing and playing. You know it's them. Not them, you know, they wrote the song. I think they have such a unique sound. As bluegrass moves forward, I think they're really right, you know, not in the way out stuff, but they're right still in that pocket, but they have such a tight band sound and such a unique, recognizable sound, and it's good.
Yeah, they are really tight. But you know what? So are many bluegrass bands.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That's sort of what it means to be a bluegrass band, is to be tight. Audiences who don't know bluegrass, when they see a tight bluegrass band, they're bowled over. Because, you know, I play a lot of places around, and sometimes they're just coming to see the movie actor.
Right.
But they get blown away by the tightness of the playing of everybody. It's like watching a string quartet, quintet in this case, or a sextet in our case.
Yeah.
And audiences will be very impressed with the musicianship of bluegrass musicians.
I have to tell you that I've had several requests from musicians that I know without naming them to thank you for shedding a nice, nice, bright, happy light on bluegrass music.
Well, you know, I'm getting benefit from it because I love it. I've always loved the music. So I think it's a byproduct of what I'm doing is that
industry
gets to hear bluegrass in a very nice way, and I think one of the best things that's happened, and it's really just happened in the last 10 years, is that bluegrass and the 5-string banjo is finally divorced from kind of the image of how do I say it? You know, the image that Heehaw gave.
Yeah.
Yeah, that Heehaw gave it.
Right.
By the way, I'm not critical of that, but it, you know, I went to a jazz club actually to see Bela Fleck. This is about 3-4 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that the audience came, was packed, it came for dinner, and everybody was dressed up. And I thought, that's not what the audience does for a bluegrass show.
Right.
And it's a difference in image of a bluegrass and jazz. But now, I sincerely believe that has changed, that a kind of respectability has come for bluegrass and the banjo, and people have really forgotten that it's coveralls and hayseeds.
Well,
and it's a really important moment for this music.
I think you're right. And when think about...
And by the way, Flatten Scruggs and Bill Monroe always wore suits.
That's right. You are correct. And when you went to see them, you were going to a show.
Right.
And they came on stage and they gave you a show. And I'm not saying that, when you aren't either, that current bands don't do that, but you're right. It's kind of coming back full circle that... And when you think about players like Bela and Tony Trischka... they've done things consistently, and to me, Tony is the ascended living master of banjos. He does everything well, and he's just a nice guy. But you think about where he's played, the different, what we would used to call highbrow arts arenas, where Tony's just moves in easily and plays in front of crowds that I would have never seen a banjo player before.
He's a knockout. That's a person. By the way, when I first came into bluegrass world, which now is about 4 or 5 years ago, as a kind of, we'll call it a professional banjo player, and I went down to IBMA and I started meeting banjo players, starting with Pete Wernick.
Oh, yeah.
I was amazed at the generosity and intelligence of everyone. They're funny and genuine and kind, and it's an amazing group of people. And
kind of goes against the grain of that public image when you actually meet these guys.
That
kind of goes against the grain of that public image you were talking about. When you're right. I mean, it's amazing. They're well, we were talking off the air a minute about the Hot Rise.
By the way, I don't think that the image is real. It's in the mind of the public. Okay. You know, it sort of endured from the television image of people who played the music, but it's not a genuine image of the players.
You're right.
You know?
You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, all right.
I just stopped talking.
No, it's okay. Well, that was very dramatic. It was a dramatic pause, and I didn't have the right cue from the stage. I'm sorry. We were talking off the air about Hot Rise, and I still, when I think about that band, and you had Pete Wernick, and you were talking about Tim O'Brien and all the other members of that band, there were some heavyweights, not only musically, but you could have conversations in that group about anything on the planet.
Oh, yeah. You know, by the way, Hot Rives was, you know, my musical life changed because of the internet. I was able to find music that I could never find before. Because of Amazon, I was able to buy records. Because of Sirius Radio, I was able to tune into bluegrass stations. I was able to find bluegrass radio on the internet, and I was able to access music that I just couldn't access. And that's when I first heard Hot Rise, and I thought, wow, this is the bluegrass I love.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started, I think I said in an interview something about Pete Wernick, and he wrote me and said, I'm the banjo player you admired. And I talked to Mark. I said something about Mark Johnson's playing, and he sent me a record. He said, actually, Mark heard I was back in playing, and he sent me one of his records, and I put it on. I thought, wow, this is the playing I aspire to. So,
I remember that article, and I will tell you this: when that article came out that you mentioned, Pete. This is just a small world to me, and I was wandering around at IBMA, and I love Pete Warning to death. He's just one of my favorite humans on the planet, bluegrass or not, banjo or not, musician or not. I was talking to Pete, and I said, "Well, Pete, you got a nice mention in a recent thing that Steve Martin talked about, you know, reviewing, hearing your records, and how much what was it?" And he said, "What was this?" And he read it, and I think that may have been around the same time that you guys were just starting to hook up again. And boy, you could not have hooked up with a doc. You know, he's Dr. Banjo because he plays banjos, but he's got all kinds of advanced degrees. He's a brilliant guy, nice man, and just a good fellow to keep up with in general. I mean, you can't ask for more than Pete Warnick to have as a friend.
I had the luxury of meeting Earl Scruggs very early in my life, and he was very generous too. You know, taught me a song here and there. But that was through John McEwen.
Well,
he's been a lifelong friend.
Do you have I don't know how much time you've got here, Steve. I don't want to take up your whole day, obviously. But can we play another tune, and then maybe can we come back?
Absolutely. I can go a little while. Okay. I'm enjoying myself. So.
Okay, good.
Let's play another song.
I know one that I'd like to play, and we talked about it earlier. I'm a big fan of Esperanza Spalding, and I want to talk to you a little bit about how you got her in. And I was doing a little research this morning. Lately, I guess, as I'm reading the liner notes again, and Edie talks about the Mold Gold Cape Object Number 19 as an inspiration for this song. So now I actually know what she's talking about. But I love the bass line from Esperanza Spalding. And if you would allow me to play King of Boys from the same Love Has Come For You.
This is probably the least bluegrass song on the record.
I know. I recognize
the one that leans toward jazz more than anything. But when I wrote the banjo part for this, it was toward the end of our, it's like this eighth or ninth song in that we were writing, and I thought, and she was always responding so well to what I was sending her. And I thought, I'm gonna push her a little bit on this. And because I always found that when you take an artist and push them a little bit, they respond in kind. And she happened to have been reading a book called History of the World in 100 Objects.
Yeah.
And she discovered this story of a gold cape that was discovered, I believe it was, in Scotland. And this song tells the story of it was the gold cape of a boy, and he was a boy king, and he died in the and they buried him in the cape, and of course the cape was immediately dug up and stolen.
Sure.
And they could see his ghost wandering the hills in the with the gold cape.
Yeah, well, that's a great...
And we got a beautiful Esperanza Spalding, beautiful playing Esperanza Spalding to play bass on this with this incredible bass break that you can literally hear the wood of the bass.
Yes.
Line. Oh, it's in the bass. It's
this,
amazing.
This for me recently. Now, I've been listening to it for a while, and I have favorites every other day. This will be my favorite. This will be, right now, just as we're speaking right now, the one that I would call a car stopper that I would want to, I better pull over and listen to this more, with more intent, is this King of Boys. It just right now it's slaying me. The rest of the album is great. I've had other favorites. I love Esperanza music. I love jazz. I love what she's doing. And people that listen to this show know that I play non-bluegrassy things all the time. I've had Ryan Cavanaugh on, and we talked about music that he's playing. I just like doing it. So with your okay, I'm going to play King of Boys,
sure,
even
of
though we're...
Can
we're,
you play it so I can hear it, too? I'd love to listen in on the...
Well, if you're on the internet, you can listen to it.
Oh, okay.
If I turn my speakers on now, we're going to get feedback, and we're just going to
get a
little
scroll.
Okay.
I'll play it on my iPhone.
You just pretend. Pretend like you're there again, and it's all happening again. All right. Give me a few seconds, and then start it up in your mind. All right. Hold on a second. Steve and I were chatting behind King of Boys. I didn't want to get into the next song yet, but we're back now. And King of Boys, we were talking about Esperanza Spalding, and the way you recorded this album, Steve, you were when we were off the air there, you were talking about you and Edie got together and did your parts, and then the other parts were assembled, sort of.
Well, yeah, Edie and I had a window where we wanted, if we didn't record them in June, we had to wait till October. So we really wanted to record our parts, and so she and I went to Frank Fischetti's studio in New Jersey. It's in his house, which was a very cozy environment, a way to record our songs. It was just the two of us, and Peter and Frank. And it was a great way to record our end of it. And then Peter took the tracks to Los Angeles, where all the musicians we wanted were. And we added the strings and Waddy Wachtel and Sarah and Sean Watkins, mm-hmm. and Esperanza Spalding there.
A nice cast was assembled around this album. Yes. I mean, mm-hmm. it really is just top flight.
And by the way, Nikki Sanders from the Steep Canyon Rangers plays fiddle on Siamese Cat, mm-hmm. beautiful sort of Bob Wills type fiddle break. He's an incredible musician. Can play, from A to Z on that thing.
Does he have some classical training? Why do I think that?
Yes, he did.
Yeah,
absolutely. Right. That's how he started. Yeah. And then he heard bluegrass and decided he wanted to become a bluegrass musician.
Well, who wouldn't?
Yeah.
Let me ask you another question real quick here. Bright Star. What have I've read about Bright Star. What is Bright Star when you talk about this album?
When Amy and I started working on these songs and we were done, we started talking about a musical because we felt our songs were very melodic. And we wanted to write a musical that had a lot, where the songs were very melodic, where every song was very melodic. And I had attempted a musical once, but I didn't like the story I had, so I abandoned it. And so we thought for a little while, and we found a story that we really like, and it's based on a true incident. And we have since then developed. We used some songs from Love Has Come For You, and then we wrote another at least 14 songs.
Oh, wow.
And now we're going to workshop it in the summer here in New York, and we have a date to perform it at a theater, which we're not allowed to reveal yet, on the West Coast. And then, we'll see what happens with it. It's become my number one project in my life, actually.
Well, good. And it's... And I'm not divulging any secrets. At the time frame is what, the 20s and 20 to 40s range?
Yes, that's right. It's actually set in 1945, and then it jumps between 1945 and 1922-23. It's set in North Carolina. It sort of tells the story of a woman's life, not her life, but her secret past that she doesn't even know about. So...
Well,
that kind of story.
Great. And so do you think that it was a continuation of the process that you and Edie had on these songs, or did you, when you were finished, you just thought, let's take this and make a musical? How does that work?
We both had the same feelings about musicals, but in that we loved them. And we just sat on that feeling for a while. And then the idea for the story came to us, and that just really excited us. It's a little premature.
Oh, no. I just saw a blurb on the internet, and I thought, well, I'll ask him about this, but please don't.
And we have a great director, Walter Bobby, who directed Chicago on Broadway, and we're very, very excited about it. And it's a different adventure because when you write a song, it can't be just a generic song. It actually has to be from the character's point of view, and they have to express what's going on in the story. So it just can't be, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. You know?
Could be, but probably nobody would like it.
Yeah, it has to be much more specific, and the person has to answer back in the context of the story in these duets.
Yeah.
So it's got a little bit of a double challenge to it. It's cool. Very, very interesting. And Edie has been brilliant at fulfilling the lyrical challenge of the musical form.
Thanks for that much information. But I appreciate it, we'll keep everything. You mentioned John McEwen, and for listeners out there, I know who John is. Obviously, you do. But I mean, explain your connection with John, and maybe your early days of banjo playing. If you have just another minute, because you mentioned his name.
Yeah, John McEwen and I went to high school together, but I knew him a little bit in high school. You know, when I was 15 or 16. But then when I first heard the banjo, and I was interested in my girlfriend, when I was 16, my girlfriend's father had a banjo, but it was a four string. I didn't know there was a difference between a four string and a five string. And then someone said, well, you know, John McEwen plays banjo.
Yeah.
I said, what? Someone in our high school plays banjo?
Oh, so after you. Yeah. Okay.
And so I went over to his house, and there was, like, jams going on. And his brother Bill became my manager later in life. And that's, I started going to his house and jamming with a five-string banjo.
And John is just an absolute string wizard. I mean, he actually has an album by that name, but Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, I guess. Maybe that's the context for the general
and then
people.
Then he got in the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and I used to open the show for them, and so we've been friends all this time.
Wow.
It's literally been 50 years.
Wow. Any other tunes from this? I know you keep getting people walking through when we're off the air. I appreciate so much you calling in. I think this has been a pretty...
I should probably get going, but, you know, I think you should play something sort of in the bluegrass vein for your bluegrass listeners.
All right.
I would think something like Sarah Jane or Stray Dog might be good.
Well, let's do Sarah Jane and the Iron Mountain Baby. I've played Get Along Stray Dog. It's a great tune, and I'm not objecting to it. But I know on this program I've not played Sarah Jane and the Iron Mountain Baby. Can you hang on till that's over, then we can come back?
Yeah, I can give you a little backstory on that too.
Okay, go ahead. Go.
This is a story about a baby that was discovered in 1904 by a man. The baby was discovered in a suitcase, and the baby was thrown from a train.
Oh.
And the man took the baby home. And he and his wife nursed it back to health. And it was a big story. And people tried to claim him. And they ended up keeping the baby and raising the baby its whole life. It became kind of a famous story.
Oh, okay.
And so Edie wrote these lyrics that sort of give options to what could have been the reason the baby was thrown from the train.
Wow. Okay. Well, good. I didn't know that. Thanks. All right. We're going to play then. We're talking to Steve Martin. We're going to take a break here and play from Steve's and Edie Brickell's new album, Love Has Come For You. And he just gave you the setup, great setup, for Sarah Jane and the Iron Mountain Baby. So hold on 1 second and give this a listen. We'll be right back. All right. That was... And you heard the story from Steve Martin, Sarah Jane and the Iron Mountain Baby, and another just a great tune. Steve, we were talking while we were off the air about you're actually going into the concert mode, I guess, soon, with the Steep Canyon Rangers and Edie Brickell, and you were telling me how you're going to present it on stage. And tell
us. Yes, we're going to. You know, I've been touring with the Steep Canyon Rangers for about 4 years now, and so this year we're going to tour with the Steep Canyon Rangers and Edie Brickell. So we're going to open the show with about 55 minutes probably with the Rangers and myself. It'll take a 20-minute intermission, or 15, ideally 15 minutes, but it usually goes to 20. And then we'll come back with myself and the Rangers and Edie and do our songs, and then we'll close with all of us together doing some other tunes that we usually close our show with. Okay. That sort of bluegrass thing.
And I told you, you're going to be up the road from me. I'm in the tip of Northern Kentucky, and you're going to be up in Dayton, a nice facility called the Fraze Pavilion. I believe it's July 28th. I'm just strictly on memory. You'll like it there. It's about an hour up the road for where I'm at in the northern part of Kentucky, just across from Cincinnati. So, but you don't have to look that far ahead. I'm just telling you, if anybody's listening, track it down somewhere. And it sounds like it'd be a good time. Hey, Steve, thanks so much, man, for doing this.
Yeah,
I really appreciate
it. Yeah,
it's
been my pleasure. I'm just looking up that date. July 28th is, that's just Carmel, Indiana. That could be it, actually. Yeah, it's probably that date. It's probably date.
Well,
I really enjoyed myself.
Well, good.
I hope your listeners enjoyed listening to the music.
I think they did. And, as always, everybody that comes on, I hope you're happy with how we went. I'm very informal, as you can tell. And if you ever want to come back, you know how to reach me. It doesn't have to be an hour every time. It can just be to say hello.
Okay. Really enjoyed it.
Hey, thank you, Steve. We're going to let you go. That was fun. I hope you all enjoyed that. Steve is very busy. There were people there were phone calls coming in between the time we were chatting and music was playing, and we had talked earlier in the day about if we could squeeze a half hour in. As I look at my clock, we're close to an hour. He's just a very generous man, and we didn't have things laid out. We just kind of talked, as you can tell, as I normally do. It went where it went, and I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks so much, Steve Martin, and thanks, Steve and Edie Brickell, for putting a great record out. Love Has Come For You. He told me during one of the breaks that it's number 21 on Billboard, so that makes me feel good that people are picking it up. It's just a wonderful, you've heard samples from it. We're going to play another one as I get off of the vocal part here. I will play you the other tune, and if you've listened to the program, you've heard this before, Get Along Stray Dog. I'm going to play that, and then we'll get back into the regular music mode here on Steve Martin's Unreal Bluegrass. Interesting day, don't you think?